Welcome to the Shake Up the World podcast hosted by Shreyas Prakash. This podcast attempts to have a positive dialogue about the future. In this exploration, I interview futurists, designers, field specialists, and experiential experts in understanding the future better. Sometimes, anticipating the future is very different from predicting the future. For today's episode, I have with me Leticia Vitto. She is a writer and a prominent speaker about the future of work. Leticia is also an editor-in-chief of the HR media, Welcome to the Jungle, a leading media that helps companies develop, in her own words, employer branding for the new work generation. She has also constantly published her work in London School of Economics, Business Review, Medium, as well as Malt. I discovered her writings through her Substack publication, where she specifically covered future of work from a feminist point of view. This eventually became a rabbit hole of discovery by going through all her posts and investigating the nuances of her opinion, which pushed me to reach her on Twitter and start this conversation. This podcast does exactly that. How does future of work look from a feminist point of view? Let's try to answer that. Talking about, say, feminism, I do understand that there are various interpretations of what it means, right? So before we get into a whole conversation on feminism as well as future of work, I would first try to understand from your lens, like, how do you define feminism, after which we could like proceed more deeper into it?
I define it quite simply as equal opportunities, no matter what gender you have, so that you can be free to choose whatever you want to do and then have an equal chance of succeeding because there are no barriers in the path to success. But in fact, the second answer, that's the first easy answer. We could stop there, but the second answer is more complex because what you choose to do and what you want to do is in fact largely determined by the stories you were told, the models you have, the culture you are the product of. And you may think you want something and it's your free choice, but in fact, it was something that was largely influenced by the environment. So the second element is having more awareness of the influence of that environment and working on that environment for less conditioning and more actual free choice. To give you one example, depending on what culture you come from, as a woman, you will want or not want to have children. That is seen as something that's so personal, so intimate, right? It's something that you personally want. It's in your guts. Also, as a man, you know, whether or not you want children is something that you think is so individual. And in fact, it's shaped by your environment so much. And so there are huge differences. For example, in Germany, where I live now, a lot of people my age, a lot of women my age, do not want children. And they do not want children because there were, you know, like environmental movements that said that children are bad for the environment.
But there was also neonatalism, right? They
exactly
feel that it's not so sustainable to have children.
Yeah, which is a horrible thing to say because we're talking about people. We're not talking about consuming something, you know. And then there was in Germany also the children, the grandchildren of Nazi Germans who said, you know, let's end this. And the, probably a large part of this anti-natalist movement was also linked to anti-Nazism in Germany. But it's just one example. But there's a third explanation in Germany. It's that the expectations of, you know, around motherhood are so high. You expect so much from mothers, you know, that they give themselves entirely to their children and not have other
ambitions. It's usually the woman who take the sacrifice, right? And even in terms
exactly.
of choices of work, it's usually the woman. Yeah. And there's always a trade-off. Sometimes it happens between work, growing up the career ladder, or should you take something for the better off the whole family, right? And it's usually in the burden of the woman to take that switch.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's why fewer women who are ambitious and want to have a career have children, versus in France, which is my home country, where it's more culturally acceptable for mothers to have careers as well. And when they, I mean, it's actually kind of disparaged for, or, you know, not really well considered if you want to have, if you have children and you stop working. It's not something that's culturally, you know, very well regarded in France, unlike in Germany. And so this very individual choice ends up being also largely influenced by the community, the culture, the environment, and that link between the individual and the community, that is at the heart of my feminism. I want to shed light on those things, what the biases that we have and the way we make decisions and how it's shaped by things that are larger than individuals.
There was also this one part of your article which I read. So you were mentioning about these thoughts which you're having when you are young in terms of a meritocracy, and how ideally it is a place where everyone has equal opportunities, right? I mean, you're not really distinguishing any person based on gender or ethnicity and so on. But then at the same time, it usually doesn't happen that you have equal opportunities, because you have various systemic layers, the fabric of society, even in this case of what you were mentioning in your own society in France, where there is this push from the society, if say the woman don't work after having given birth to a baby, right? So what are your thoughts on that? Because I have been thinking about this as well in terms of meritocracy versus a more diverse society, and what are the pros and cons, trying to look at very objectively. So just to get a perspective from this.
That's an excellent question, because meritocracy, who would be against it? It's this idea that based on merit, people will be promoted just according to, you know, input and merit. It's a brilliant idea. Who would be against it? Philosophically, it's very hard to oppose. And the reality is that organizations and groups of people who talk a lot about meritocracy are usually not meritocratic. So, for example, among tech companies and startups where there are very few women, extremely few, usually you have white men telling you, we're a meritocracy, which is a way of saying to everyone who doesn't look like them, you're just not good enough for us, which is just a horrible message. And it also shows how ignorant they are about all the reasons and the biases that prevent other people from succeeding in their organization. And so it starts with recruitment, where you have actually active discrimination, where you have a set of criteria to judge merit that actually excludes lots of people. If you judge, if your definition of merit is you have to be able to climb a tree, you will just promote monkeys, and the elephants in your company or the fish in your company will not get promoted, because the criteria is not how well you can swim or how big you can be or whatever you can do with your trunk or I don't know what, but the metaphor has its limits. But you see my point. So basically the way you define merit, the way you define success is generally flawed. So much that only one set of people will be promoted. It's true also about a lot of evaluations in schools and in the French Grande École, there are those competitive examinations, and they generally make it a lot easier for people who share a set of cultural codes, the same culture. And so people who come from different social backgrounds will find it much harder to succeed, even when they are extremely talented, just because they don't master the right social codes. And it has nothing to do with merit.
Interesting example, because I've also been going through this whole application process, right, for say a career in the choice of the field which I want. So one particular aspect which they look at, apart from say the merit angle, which is of course your qualification, is in terms of likability, right? So you need someone who fits to the cultural code and understands their vocabulary and fits right in. So I do realize that when you evaluate a person based on likability, it also comes with its share of biases as well. And that could really create more disparity.
Absolutely. Likeability is a great example, because that's something that was used by recruiters for a very long time. You know, whether or not someone's likable, you will have a tendency to recruit them or not. And it seems like a good enough way of recruiting people, because most people would agree on who's likable and who's not. And when you look deeper into it, number one, you tend to find likable people who are a bit like you, so who share the same cultural background, etc., and who have the same political affiliation, the same body language or things like that. So you tend to like people who look a lot like you. And number two, even things like eye contact and smiling and criteria that you may see as objectively, you know, objectively related to likability, are in fact culturally determined. So there are cultures where people smile less, there are cultures where eye contact is not the done thing. And you have also this idea that people who are, for example, autistic will not do eye contact the same way. So you exclude people who are neurologically different, because those criteria are very much biased.
So I was actually listening to this podcast which you had with Nina Goswami, who was talking about the BBC 50-50 project. And I was actually listening to it while on a run. I was just on a run and listening to this podcast. And I found it very interesting, her perspective on, say, diversity itself, that everyone says that we are making our workforce more diverse, but at the same time, if it is not measurable, it just becomes some kind of a fancy statement, which they're just saying for the sake of saying, right? And that's when I was really thinking about this whole aspect of, say, equality in terms of diversification. How do you really perceive that? So her view was that it would be better if, say, we had a 50-50 say distribution, right, in terms of men and women, so that we can, of course, she was also providing a business case for this, that BBC could get more viewers out of it. But I also want to understand from your lens, how do you perceive that? So this is also something which I have been thinking about, because I recently came across a quote by RBG, the famous Supreme Court judge of United States. So she had this quote, and I just want to pull it up because it's something really relevant. So she says that during the time, there was a lot of disparity as well, right, in terms of women judges not being very much represented. So she was, so one of the judges had asked if, say, what do you think is the ideal version of, say, feminism, right? What do you think would be a ideal society if, say, there is complete representation, like, say, 4 or 5 women judges with 4 men judges? And she said that that's not what I perceive as the ideal society. I see it at a case where if all of the women judge, all the judges are women, and the society is not surprised by the fact that they are all women. So that's when I perceive as an ideal society, that people are not shocked, because when all of them are men, we don't really look at it in a very different lens, right? So I found that to be a very interesting quote as well. So how do you perceive that?
It reminds me of that quote about mediocrity, that we will really have moved ahead and made progress when no one is shocked that there is a mediocre woman somewhere in a position of power, because there are so many mediocre men everywhere around, and that's not a subject. And, mm-hmm. and women in positions of power are very often exceptionally brilliant women, because they had to fight so hard and be better and really be good. And so the way you can judge that that we've reached a new level of equality is when it's as easy for a mediocre woman to get in a position of power as it is for a mediocre man. So that quote of Ruth Bader Ginsburg reminded me of that. It's interesting. Yeah, it's very true. In general, you mentioned Nina Goswami. So she's the head of diversity of the BBC, and she is in charge of this program, which started 3 years ago, of putting as many women as men on screen. And now also they have different criteria. They want different ethnic groups. They want different, different cultures. They want also disabled people to be visible. So it's like lots of different criteria. It becomes super complex to manage, I imagine, because when it's just gender, of course you have non-binary gender, but still, by and large, it's easier to measure, right? You count men and women on screen. So with a few exceptions of people who cannot be counted that way, it's you have metrics. But when you include other forms of diversity, where do you stop? You know, it's just like what diversity, I mean, how many people from how many different groups can you even measure? So it's super, super tough. And I think the BBC developed a methodology when it comes to counting, defining criteria, et cetera, that's like super efficient, and they've gone really, really far. And that's what makes me optimistic. It's like the idea that you need to be able to count something to realize whether or not you've made progress, to count, to be accountable. That's an idea that's now very much accepted in large organizations and politics and everywhere. Like quotas are not taboo anymore. So that in board of administrators, we need 40%. It's most often it's 40% the quota, but depending on the places, could be 50, depending on the organization and the type of institution you talk about. It's just that I think this idea that we need metrics, that we can count, that we should count, and that is what will make you accountable, that's an idea that's made a lot of progress.
Yeah, I think this is also something I've been thinking about in terms of diversity. So I'll just play devil's advocate here. So because on the flip side of things, when we talk about diversity, say how much is too much, right? So when in terms of, 50-50 is quite easy to represent, like 50% men and women. But then the dialogue becomes even more complex when you have so much of ethnicities, races, and gender. And adding to that, you have this concept of intersectionality, where you have like a combination of, say, underrepresented minorities, which even add more things to the spectrum, and it becomes very difficult in case of policymakers as well as say the board members to really formulate laws to make it more distributed. So this is where I want to understand, like, if we are again, the goal is to provide equal opportunities, but then sometimes when it becomes a matter of say diversifying as much, what if there is a trade-off on the merit angle of things, because it's evaluated in a different lens, right? It's evaluated based on diversity. So how do we really navigate those complex factors in this junction?
That's an amazing question, because at the beginning, I think when you start making progress on diversity, you always have that trade-off. It's a question of image, that you're giving somebody a position basically because of whatever community they belong to rather than whatever they did professionally, for example, or a little bit of a, yeah, it's always a little bit of a trade-off. But I think that's a first phase. That's when you're at the very beginning of something, let's say overnight in a political organization with no women, you have to recruit women. And then you will just not be too picky. You'll just pick women because they're women, right? And not necessarily what their achievements are. But that's just the first step, because the generation after, and the generation after is just a couple of years after in terms of recruiting. It's so accepted that there are as many women as men that to get there as a woman, it's not any easier anymore, because it's the next generation. And it's as hard for any group to and any category to get there. And you have the role models and you have the experience and you have the pools from which to recruit, because you know, at every level you have more of them, and then it gets as hard for everyone, and you will not have many mediocre people from that group anymore. So perhaps the first generation is not based on merit, perhaps. But the truth is, it's rarely the case. It's rarely the case that the people recruited based on their identity is actually super mediocre. It's very rare. Let's take the case of, I don't know, African-Americans in the US. For many years, there were none of them. The few of them who were recruited as kind of tokens, and white people said, oh, it's just because of your skin color that you were recruited, et cetera. But there were so few of them that the few of them who actually were picked were rarely mediocre. They were actually often quite exceptional people, exactly.
Does it look more like a power struggle? Like, say, is it like more like a seesaw where men have been on the top for quite some time, probably for decades now, and it's important for women to get that push to come back, and it has to balance it out a bit, right? So I kind of look at it in that way.
Yeah, there's a power struggle. There's always a power struggle. I mean, if you're a group of people with power, would you want to share it? Not necessarily. It's very comfortable to have people who are who you can exploit and dominate. And you created a set of stories and myths and ideas to kind of make your domination more acceptable. And it requires a little bit of struggle and activism, and it will not be given to anyone. Power will never just be handed to you.
Yeah. So in India, we also have the system, you might have heard of the caste system as well, right?
Yeah.
Maybe I'll just shed some light on what's happening, because there is a way in which that power could also be misused, right? So for instance, right from the time when the government was formed, there were these underrepresented communities of Dalits who needed a voice as well. And they were completely outcast from the mainstream professions. They were given what they consider, say, low status work, like say sewage cleaning and so on. So there was a huge, like a rebellion to kind of represent them more actively. And then there was the caste, the reservation emerged through this so that they could also be represented in sense. But in some cases, there were also, say, places where the law was being used to also in terms of, say, promotions. Some places the promotion was given because of them being of such, say, caste and so on. So and also because of the way the political system is, right? So you have the vote banks where politicians make various promises that if you give us the votes, we will help you to get so and so statuses. So again, this is quite evident here. We could also see what could happen if it is not really taken care of in the right way. So
like nepotism and corruption and lots of issues. And you're the largest democracy on the planet, so there are also the largest problems of corruption, nepotism, etc. Of course.
Into the angle of, say, culture. So in one of your podcasts, one of your news studies, you mentioned that culture eats technology for breakfast. So I found that to be a very interesting quote, that how, say, like we think that technology shifts the society so fast, but then like say one rebellion or one agitation could really change the way we look at the world, right? So any thoughts on that regard?
Yes, so maybe a few words about that that sentence, culture eats technology for breakfast. It's it was inspired by another quote that sounds a little bit the same, which is Culture Eats Strategy for Breakfast, which is by a management professor, Peter Drucker. And his idea was that, yeah, culture actually, and the way you execute a project and a plan will matter more than, you know, vision and strategy and things like that. So I use this, I kind of alluded to this quote by Peter Drucker, and my idea is that, yeah, when we talk about the future and when we imagine the future, we have a tendency to focus on the tech of the future, like what will the iPhone 25 look like, and what kind of computers will we have, and what kind of artificial intelligence will we have, and will we have singularity and things like that, and we want to imagine a world where we have flying cars and flying self-driving cars, preferably, and things like that. And we want to imagine something that will be very different from a technological point of view. And the futurists of the past did the same. So a lot of the people in the 60s, they imagined things like the internet. They imagined things like
flying cars as well, right?
Cars, which they were very disappointed we never got. But yeah, they imagined lots of those things. But for example, when they imagined the office of the future, there were fax machines and things like that and computers, et cetera, but all the managers were men. They couldn't imagine that the largest revolution in the world of work would be many more women having positions in corporations and not just secretaries, but all kinds of jobs. And this revolution of the 70s, 80s was a female revolution. It was a cultural revolution. It was not about tech. And the question that I ask is, what matters more? Is it, this large cultural change, which has many implications, including technological, or the shape of the iPhone 34? So yes, I think culture, because it's so hard to imagine, and because it's, and because we always think about our culture as something permanent, is actually the most interesting thing compared to technology. And there's also this beautiful quote that that I think I wrote about in the newsletter you mentioned, which is that we also tend to be more interested in what changes than in what doesn't change. But sometimes the things that don't change are much more important. For example, phones change, water chemically doesn't change, but water is much more important to our survival as a species.
So in terms of future of work, coming to your thesis of your books as well, right? Can you please tell a bit more about your rationale behind going into this line, say, of future of work? I would like to get a perspective from you on that. And also in terms of how feminism as well as future of work overlap or intersect?
Great question. I started in 2015, and I started with my own story of changing jobs, not knowing what to do, having this kind of malaise. I wasn't happy at work and I didn't know what to do. And that this subject, that was a very individual, personal subject, I understood was something that was larger than me. And that work transitions, professional transitions, would be a lot more common in people's lives. So that was the first way I tackled the subject of future of work, with the angle of professional transitions, career shifts, job changes and training and things like that. And
so is it more in terms of the French way of thesis, antithesis and synthesis of really understanding the why behind work?
That's definitely a French cultural thing, but that's not how I approached it. I approached it first with my own case. So what am I going to do with my life? And what matters in professional transitions and how, and then I worked with a company that helped other people transition into other jobs. So that was just the first concrete subject that I tackled that was related to the future of work. So it was in 2015, it was my first gig, my first subject, and that's how I dived into the subject. And then I moved on to freelancers. So I was a freelancer, so it was also a personal subject, and I worked with a freelancer platform, and the subject was how do you offer the same level of benefits and protections to people who are not linked to you with a salaried contract, a traditional work contract? And on the freelancer's point of view, or on the company's point of view, it was how do we have what's culture when you have people who work for you, who are not your employees? So things like that, you know, these were the themes that I looked into.
So as a freelancer, you might have more autonomy, but then at the same time, you might not have all those packages, right, in terms of health benefits and all that comes.
Exactly.
That might be.
Absolutely. Yeah. And sometimes you don't even have autonomy. Sometimes you actually work like an employee, but just with none of the benefits. I mean, some freelancers are like that, not all, but some. So it was a super interesting subject to dive into. It made me understand also that the world of work was much more fragmented, that there were people sometimes doing the same jobs, but with very different work situations. Sometimes in the same company, you have people in the team. Some of them are consultants with a different employer. Some of them are freelancers, some of them are employees, some of them are employees on short-term contracts, other on long-term contracts, some are paid a lot more than others doing exactly the same job. And so, you know, what makes a team if no one shares the same work conditions? And that's a super difficult question. And also in a company, in an organization, you have more people who have a different employer who's the supplier of the company they actually work for. The example I usually give is that of cleaning women. In the 60s, the cleaning women in a company, they were the employee of that company. Today, more of them, most of them, work for a supplier, for an outside company, because everything was outsourced, because the cleaning services in the company were outsourced. But the reality of the job is the same. But the fact that you work for a company that's not your employer means, who do you negotiate with when you want a higher wage? Who do you talk to? Who's actually your boss?
The company structures have changed, but then
exactly.
The work is still the same, right?
The work is still the same. The worker is a lot weaker when they cannot just have this normal conversation with their boss about, oh, please, can I come tomorrow a little bit later, etc. Because they have to talk to their actual employer first, who's the company selling those services to the other company that they work at. And it makes the whole thing so much more complicated, because the company who hired those services, they don't want the trouble. They don't want to manage a human being. They just want a service. They want on-demand cleaning services. It's not my problem. That's the reason why I outsource the services, is because I don't want to have to deal with that person, that worker. And so for the worker, it's a position of weakness, because they have no one to talk to. And usually their leverage, their negotiating power
is
not what it used to be, exactly.
And they're also viewed as, say, low skill workers, right? In terms of the type of profession.
Yes. I hate that expression, low skill, because it actually reflects a view of work that's completely flawed, and that's sexist and racist and anti-immigrant, etc. Because it's actually, what do we value? And the idea that a job is low skill just because it's badly paid and because it's given to immigrants does not reflect the reality of the job itself, because sometimes it requires incredible skills. And looking after elderly people and you know, looking after children. It takes a lot of skills, but it's just super badly paid and not valued. And that's why we call it low skill, but it doesn't make it any less essential. This is essential work. So it's, I'm trying not to use low skill anymore.
Yeah, I mean, you also had mentioned about, say, caring, right? Like, say, the differences between, say, caring and knowing. And that, say, why is it that the most important jobs, like, say, for caring for others, for the elderly or for the frontline, like in terms of hospitals and nurses, what they're doing is commendable at the situation. But despite the fact of them being overworked and understaffed, right? It's not really being acknowledged as much in terms of work as work.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a very artificial distinction, because caring requires knowing, and knowing requires caring. When it comes to health, for example, if you separate the two, it means you have no understanding of how the soul influences the body, how being loved will just make you automatically much healthier. You'll just feel better and you'll just be better. There will be lots of hormonal changes going through your body, and just someone holding your hand actually has an effect on health. It's part of healing. And so this very artificial separation, historic separation between nurses and doctors goes against everything we are now discovering about how health works, how caring and knowing are very much related, and we need both.
Well, even like just a segue to what you just mentioning. So you also mentioned about the artificial notions of what is considered as a useful employee, right? In terms of productivity, and even in terms of the example of hospitals you mentioned, we are really not looking at, say, how many of the nurses or the doctors are caring for their patients, but rather have these notions of metrics which doesn't make sense sometimes, like trying to see how many number of patients you are covering in a day, right? Which might look well in a capitalistic point of view, but then it is not the objective of a hospital to serve and to treat the patients. So what are your thoughts on this in terms of measurable nonsense in terms of such?
Yes, measurable things. Value. We have an economic system that's based on the idea that we can measure value. And in some cases we can. If you produce cars, the number of cars that come out of the assembly line is the value you've produced in a day or made in a day. And in some cases, when it's not just tangible, but when the way you measure is very much related to the value you sell, there's no problem at all. In some cases, there's no problem at all. But in a lot of services that deal with caring or teaching, that deal with knowledge or well-being or health, we have developed metrics to measure value that have nothing to do with actual value. Let me just illustrate that with the thing you mentioned a moment ago. For example, in hospitals, the things that are measured are the number of medical procedures that are performed at a given hospital, or the number of shots that are given, the number of appointments that are made, but not the health of the patients or the health of the community in which that hospital functions. So it's like sometimes it's even quite the reverse. I mean, the fact that you measure the number of procedures will create an incentive to deliver more procedures, even if that actually destroys the health of the patient. As a typical example is, the surgery went well, the patient died, but the surgery went well, and we can bill it. So for the hospital, it's value because the surgery is billed. It was a perfect surgery. Okay, the patient died, but that's just a side effect. That's just a detail. Doesn't matter. Surgery went well.
Even if the health deteriorates, it has economic value.
To the point that the patient dies, yes.
Yeah, so I mean, from this, I kind of see that there are like different kinds of work. Like, on one aspect, I see like, say, creative work, which is more of what the knowledge workers do. And then you have work which involves caring, which, say, the nurses do, right? And you also have, say, physical work, which might involve lifting things or a conveyor belt, pushing type of roles, right? So, of course, there has been certain distinctions in terms of what is considered to be of superior economic value. And so on, right? So, where do you see all these fronts, and do you think it should be something different?
We have this, we inherited the categories of the past that are very much gendered. So there was this separation between work that was productive, and that included creative, physical, and what the third thing you mentioned, I forgot what it was, but the care, no, not care, sorry, productive, that was producing, right? Producing value and reproductive. It's the idea that it's all the work that goes into reproducing the workforce. So the present workforce that's like feeding yourself and your family, feeding the workers, today's workers, but also making children and feeding your children, looking after the home that will make it possible for them to sleep well and reproduce the workforce, present and future workforce. And so that includes care work, that includes teaching and training and a lot of nursing and looking after children, all those things that historically defined as reproductive work. And reproductive work in that historical separation was given more to women, and a lot of it was not paid, was unpaid. And because of that legacy of reproductive work being unpaid, because it was supposedly paid for by the reproductive work of the spouse, that's a legacy we've not been able to shed and to transcend. And the result is that work that was historically defined as reproductive is valued very little, is paid very little, is in competition with unpaid work going on in the home. And that legacy is super hard, and it's still extremely gendered. When you look at nurses today, it's 90% women in most European countries. When you look at nannies, it's also between 19 and 100% women. When you look at the people who look after the elderly, it's 99% women. And in France, it's 99%. I don't know what that figure is in India, but I'm pretty sure it's a lot of women.
I mean, I have to be honest here. So when I read this, the classification of, say, productive work and reproductive work, I had never actually thought of it in this way, like that, say, the reproductive work is actually, in some way, you are giving birth to the future generation, which will add economic value as well, right? So that was a very interesting way to look at it. Yeah.
That's an old distinction that was made by classical economists, like even Karl Marx used that distinction between productive and reproductive. And today it's not as relevant as it was, because a lot of the reproductive work is actually productive because it's paid. So you create revenues, and it's part of the economy, and it's exchange, it's a service you can sell. So how do you distinguish between the two? And very often it's a mix. Productive and reproductive cannot be separated. If you're a craftsman and you have a workshop, doing whatever it is that you produce, your, I don't know, let's say you make furniture, doing furniture, but also cleaning around in the workshop and feeding yourself, it's a part of one and the same thing. As a craftsman, you will do all those things at once, and you will not separate those two things. It's what makes you in. What enables you to create value and make something. So I don't, I'm not the one making that distinction. I'm criticizing that old distinction of, inherited from the 19th century. Yeah.
So, I was also thinking in terms of the current situation that, like, since we have been, like, your work is also in terms of the future of work. I also see that the future has already come in terms of remote work and the COVID restructuring a lot of things. And so, what are your perspectives on the elephant in the room, which is, say, the pandemic, and how has the present witnessing the future in some way?
Yes, the future of work is the present of work. And with the pandemic, it's very hard not to see it. It's very hard to speak about the future when it's all in the present. And the things that I wrote a couple of years ago about, you know, the fragmentation of companies and the fact that more workers no longer have all the benefits of the work contract and more precariousness, less collective negotiation for workers, all those things that are very much made visible by the pandemic. And there's one thing that worries me and there's one thing that reassures me. The thing that worries me is that the pandemic has shown that inequalities rose super fast. So gender inequalities, but also all sorts of inequalities between.
You also talk about the she session, right?
Exactly. So there's this phrase she session, which is the recession that affects women more badly. That was coined by a woman called C. Nicole Mason from a think tank, and I think in the UK or maybe in the US, I don't remember. I think in the US perhaps. And this idea that's originally an American idea is actually true across the world. So in India, the she session is probably one of the worst because most women work in the informal economy, so they don't even have an official work contract. So they do work, but with even fewer protections than their male counterparts. And with the lockdown, all the informal economy was like hit immediately. And it's like, it was super, super hard on women, like also forced marriages and things like that.
Also in terms of physical abuse. So yeah. Because of the pandemic, what has happened right now is that most of the men who work have lost their jobs and they are sitting at home and frustrated with everything. And they vent out their frustration on their spouses, which is leading to a lot more of these domestic violence, abuses and so on for the women as well.
Terrible. Yeah, absolutely. And it's what's true about India is true to a lesser extent in other countries. Even in Japan, there's one figure that I find absolutely terrible. It's the rise of female suicide. So it used to be that more men, it's not a nice thing to say, but more men committed suicide than women in Japan because women had a better network of, you know, people who to talk to and basically it was easier for them to talk about psychological difficulties than it was for men, but not during the pandemic because that network all of a sudden disappeared or became very fragile and a lot of women faced with increased isolation, but the same burdens and the same responsibilities, they just collapsed. And so the suicide rate went up 15% in less than 1 year. So that's just like super dramatic. So that's India, that's Japan. And then you have like in the US, it was different. It was women who left the workforce because there was no one to look after the children because all the schools were closed and it was just online schooling. And so you have like 3 million women, nearly 3 million women who left the workforce voluntarily. That's not the right adverb because they didn't choose. They had no choice.
They had no choice.
Exactly. And in every country, you have something like that. It's a different form. But the she session is that, you know, word that kind of encapsulates all the different problems that affected, you know, women particularly.
So I just want to have a segue into isolation, which you were just discussing, Ram. As you had also written more about how you are also trying to adapt in terms of an environment where you're not getting that the social, I mean, you have your social needs and emotional needs, and at the moment with the pandemic, you're not able to match up to it. So you had mentioned about how games are helping you with also coping with isolation, which I found to be quite an interesting perspective. So what are your thoughts on that regard? And as you mentioned in terms of how a lot of women are taking this voluntary stance of quitting the jobs and going towards some other aspects of like taking care of the homes. I also see that even children are facing a lot of these isolation because this is a time where they have to like just come out of the houses and play with other kids and they're not able to do that. So how is it really affecting isolation for women as well as, say, for kids? And how are they, what could be a possible solution for such aspects?
I'm very much convinced that children, teenagers, and young adults are the ones suffering the most from social isolation. They're the ones that die the least from COVID, but they're the ones that suffer the most from from the forced isolation related to the pandemic. And the reason why they suffer the most is because they don't yet have networks of relationships and people that, you know, they can count on and who they can send messages to. That's the moment when you build, exactly. And you build your identity. You don't even have yet, you don't exactly know who you are because you haven't interacted with as many people yet. And you need these interactions to find out who you are. And that really happens in those early teenage years and childhood too, probably. It's this process of interacting with others, finding out what groups you like and what groups you don't like in a high school, at school in general. That's what makes you learn more about yourself. And when they're deprived of this, not only are they alone and sad, but they don't develop cognitively and they don't develop socially and they don't find out who they are. And this is really, really, really bad. I think the impact of that we will feel for a very long time, that those generations will be lacking something. It's never too late. Of course, I hope they can still develop things. But for sure, there will be like a COVID generation. And that COVID generation is not just those who lost someone they loved, but those children who lived for a super long time in conditions that are absolutely abnormal, that are just like so weird. My 12-year-old daughter, her social life is on TikTok. And thank God she has TikTok. I'm not going to say bad things about that because the algorithms connect her with people from her geography. And so she has this sense of achievement because whatever she posts on TikTok will generate lots of views, and then she will be contacted and be able to contact people who she can meet in the flesh, in the park, with social distancing and a mask. And that's just been the one source of relationships for her. It was not school, it was not the neighborhood, it was none of that, because we're in a new country where we don't know many people. We moved to Germany during the pandemic, and so she doesn't know many people yet. But it was TikTok, and she's met like several people, some of whom she calls her friends now, on the app. So that's just like a nice thing that it's not just virtual, it's not just online, it moves offline because the two are connected. And for a lot of children, not mine, but for a lot of children, they found that kind of, you know, the weak links and the strong links and the serendipity, they found that in video games. And that's why Twitch and Discord and all those apps were so important during the pandemic, because it gave lot of young people, also older people, but we'll focus more on young people now, a sense of belonging, a sense of being able to be in a space where they can randomly meet people who share the same interests, building something, feeling that they exist, that they can relate to others. And so yeah, gaming was definitely something that helped a lot of people.
So previously we used to have this discourse that say for teenagers, it might not be so advisable to use social media because of course, the disadvantages of what it could be, right? It could give them a different form of identifying with themselves and so on. So, but then right now with the pandemic, it has so happened that they don't have any social life as such of mingling with people. So there has to be some trade-off here and there to get the right balance, right? But what is also
You're right, but you know, bullying and harassment and things like that happens in real life too. It happens at school. It happens in any kind of social relations. So what's true about social media is true about regular life media, regular life networks, I mean. But the children and young people are at risk of being abused, of
cyberbullying and so on, right?
Exactly. But it's true also at school. Mm-hmm. I mean, regular bullying, which doesn't require a computer or a smartphone, also happened a lot in schools.
It's also interesting to see how games are emerging as a form of social network, bringing all these kids together where they could chat with each other and also play the game, right? So it's much more fun and entertaining. And yeah, this is a kind of a new trend I see with how they are coping with the social stress.
It was already true before the pandemic, but before the pandemic, it was kind of frowned upon. You look at young gamers and you had this cliche that they are either, you know, nerds who are socially awkward and, you know, like, oh, these kids just in front of their computers, not seeing anybody. And in fact, what they were doing was already interacting with others, because a lot of these games were already cloud-based and based on interactions. And I think what happened is not that it emerged, is that we are looking at it differently. We are now seeing what we weren't seeing before, some of the positives of those kinds of interactions happening in the world of video games.
Yeah, I mean, previously when we used to ask a kid like what they want to become, they used to say they would want to become a pilot or an astronaut and so on. But now it's more like a YouTube star and a TikTok celebrity, and it's just changing the way they perceive what they want to be. So, yeah.
<It's> true.
I also want to touch upon some aspects of this recent article which you mentioned about the how you could perceive, say, urban landscapes, especially the geographies, in a feminist point of view, wherein you mention a very interesting point, which was not elaborated in the article. So let me just try to pull it up. So you were saying that if cities could be designed with the feminist perspective, there could be a lot more restructuring, right? So one of the things which you mentioned is that how, say, even for the fact that they sometimes take a step back when they have to take care of the baby, right? So even in those cases, if the city is well planned in such a way that the woman could support each other during these kind of situations where they share the caregiving, right? So what do you think about those aspects, and how do you think an ideal society would look where women don't have to take a step back in such situations and also support their children as well as the family and everyone involved?
Absolutely. So there are many points that you just mentioned. There's urban planning, the role of cities, and the role of feminism in thinking about cities. And all these things are very much connected. So the first thing I could say is that cities in and of themselves are dense enough to provide networks that help women who have caring, who are caregivers and who have responsibilities, find support, whether that support is institutional, like a childcare facility where they can drop their children in the morning, or a hospital where they can find a nurse if they have a medical problem, or private, like a friend who's in the same situation, who can look after their children for a couple of hours while they do something else, or a parent or grandparent or whoever. And the thing about cities is that there's a lot of density, so that you can in a limited distance have like a lot of your needs that can be met by lots of different people. Whereas imagine if you have this geography that's very much spread, that exactly, where you have more space, it looks super comfortable to have like a big mansion and a huge garden and no one else around. That's like a dream of someone who lives alone and who's an introvert. They might think, oh, it's super great, I have no one around. But for someone who has caregiving responsibilities, like children or someone who's diseased at home and et cetera, you need help. You need friends, you need support. And so for you, it's much better to have a denser environment with lots of people, because a lot of the things that you need, you can share with other people. And let's say you have neighbors with children, you can, and with a group of neighbors, you can hire a nanny, and it will not cost you much, because you can share the cost with other people. That's just one very concrete example of what cities can do to help mothers or parents in this
something
particular
like a
case.
Cooperative society where they have their needs matched by sharing the work required.
Exactly. If you live alone, you cannot have a school. Or if you live in a place where there are five households, it will be very hard to have a teacher and to have a school. Whereas if you live in a place that's very dense with lots of households, it's possible to build these institutions that are based on the idea that you can mutualize services, collective services for a group of people. And then you can also improve the quality of it because you share the costs with more people. And of course, it's not that easy because sometimes the city grows so fast that the services that are provided are insufficient. It's a place where sometimes the needs cannot be met because there are too many people and you have too little space. But a city is like a living organism that will adjust and adapt. So it takes a little bit of time, but cities in themselves are like living organisms that constantly adapt and move and evolve, and there are interesting things. And then the second thing you mentioned was feminism in urbanism or urban studies. And it's this idea that, in fact, cities that are planned and designed by men are often planned and designed with a stereotypical user or inhabitant who happens to be a man and a worker, etc. And then you will design services and infrastructures based on their needs and not the needs of other people who were not part of the design.
You also talk about the flaneur, right? The one who is dilly-dallying around the streets. But then it's not really considering the woman's perspective where they could also be prone to sexual assault in all these corners, which are not well designed. So that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, exactly. There were lots of discussions recently about lighting, about how cities should be designed, about sports facilities, that when you take in the gender element into account, usually the facilities, the sports facilities that are built like 80% of them are built for men. In fact, when you look at the users, you think, everybody pays their taxes, but the one who actually gets something in return are mostly men. So this idea that there's a gendered impact on the things that you invest in, that's an idea that's now widely acknowledged to be true. And I read this morning that a lot of cities and new cities in France, not new cities, but cities with new mayors, like Rennes in Brittany, and I don't know, there were a few other examples, now look at it with a gender lens. They look at planning, urban planning, with a gender lens. It's like, what's the impact on women? What's the impact of men? If we do this investment, if we build this bridge, who will use it, right? And that's now something that's much more common in a lot more cities, that you look at that.
And they have to consider that, right? Like when you take into account that 51% of the world's population are women, right? So it's definitely something they need to take into account.
Definitely.
That brings me to the end of this podcast. On a closing note, I also would want you to say, tell me what you've been reading at the moment. So to just get an idea, especially in terms of future of work, so that would help the audience to understand this, go through it to understand more of your thoughts.
Oh, excellent question. I should have prepared. I've read several amazing books recently. One was about housing and how housing is changing profoundly because there are strong cultural shifts. So it's an American woman called Diana Lind, and she looks at housing with a cultural perspective and says that in the US, but it's true also in the UK, for example, there was this, for decades, there was this focus on the nuclear family and the housing for a family of just, parents and children, and not multiple generations. And so there was this idea that as a young person, you need to make it out, you succeed on your own, leave your parents, create your own household, etc. But that's not the reality in America anymore, because a lot more young people live, young, I mean, 25-year-olds and 30-year-olds live with their parents.
Staying back with their parents because of the increasing cost of housing, right, or finding homes.
Yes, but it's not just the costs. It's also because otherwise the alternative is being so lonely, and multiple generations under one roof are becoming more common also for cultural reasons. So you're right, the cost of housing is the is probably the number one driver. But there are also cultural changes, because so many people are lonely and just literally touched by no one, that it's beginning to have an effect on the choices that we make. Perhaps we are better off with that parent and grandparent and aunt and et cetera, nephew, et cetera, even if it's not perfect and they have flaws and sometimes they're annoying. But the alternative is just to live in a super, super small housing unit on your own with no social interactions whatsoever. And so more people are just acknowledging that, you know, multi-generational housing, which is quite common in other cultures, and which used to be common in Western cultures too, is actually the way of the future. And in the US, they see it among Asian communities, where in among Asian communities, there are more multi-generational housing, and it's spreading to
we have it here as well. In fact, we call it as the joint families. It used to be a it used to be there quite a while, at least the previous generation, but then now we became more of nuclear families, and now we're all like living very isolated. But it really does make sense now that, I mean, what's the alternative here, right? It's the alternative is loneliness, which is definitely not something which would be a better option. But also for the fact that these joint families structured in a very different lens. So previously we used to have our grandparents as well staying with us, and all of us, all different brothers and the siblings, all the families stay together. So they used to share a lot of wisdom from their experiences. And we never used to have Google. I mean, I'm talking about the generation even earlier than my forefathers and so on. So there, they were respected and they were revered. So it used to be like a fabric around which the joint family functioned, where the elders used to be respected and their words were also like taken heed of. So it's how it's very interesting how everything has changed with the information era and how they've just become so much more fragmented.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Do you want me to name another book that I'm reading? So the book that I mentioned just a second ago is called Brave New Home. So it's about the developments and housing and the changes. And I've read another one that's very beautiful. It's called The Power of Rituals by a writer called Casper Terquil. I'm not sure how it's pronounced. Maybe you know, because it's Dutch. It's a Dutch name. Kuile. I have no idea how it's pronounced. Yeah. So it's a beautiful book that that talks about how, you know, religion is declining in a lot of countries and a lot of cultures. The religious practices are not as strong as they used to be. And but the need we have for rituals and communities and spirituality is as strong as ever. And so we need to find it somewhere else. And so it's a book about how we find rituals in different places. And so that inspired me to write several pieces about how rituals at work are super important. And perhaps the reason why we want our work to be more spiritual is because we need it to fill the needs that are not met by, you know, religious institutions the way they were before.
That's very interesting. Anyways, Leticia, it was wonderful talking to you.
Thank you, Shreyas. I'm very glad to have had that conversation.